Okay, hello everybody. So before starting this talk, I want to thank the organizers to allow me today to be here with you, to share with you one of my passions, which is the study of very high Z galaxies using gravitational telescopes. So you can understand from my talk that I am going to use gravitational telescopes as a kind of a tool to study the distant universe. Okay, I'm supposed to talk about galaxies at the reionization epoch. So the number of papers today, even if this is a review, the number of papers today on this particular subject is still very scarce. So I'll be using during my discussion a lot of results, discussions, in collaboration with different people. So I just listed, I just put the names of these people here in the bottom of this slide, just to show you that this is many people contributed to this kind of results today. So can I have? Okay, thank you very much. So, the outline of my talk is the following. I'll start just with a few ideas about the motivation for this kind of studies. Then I'll describe some recent results on gravitational telescopes used as a tool to study very high Z galaxies. And then I'll spend most of my time describing the first results, the first attempts to constrain the abundance and the properties of star-forming galaxies in this redshift domain, very high Z, using gravitational telescopes. And I will end this talk with a discussion about the perspectives of this kind of study, and in particular, trying to convince you, we start the discussion, let's see, about the fact that the efficiency of this kind of search, if do we have to use, continue to use gravitational lenses for this kind of studies, or it is better to use the results in blank fields? So this is a question we have to discuss at some point, because the future developments, in particular the instrumentation in the near-infrared, will be strongly conditioned by this kind of discussion, this kind of results. So it's really worth to be discussed. Let's start with the motivation. We are looking to the sources, the first sources formed in the universe after what is called the Dark Ages, so the first starbursts, galaxies, protogalaxies, let's say, QSOs, which started ionizing the universe at a given point. And we have the universe completely reionized at redshift around 6.5. We have today different evidences for this kind of process coming from different observations, mainly from HST, but also ground-based telescopes, and also all the constraints we obtained recently with WMAP results. Of course, we expect to start significant improvement in this kind of domain we're using the GWST in the future, but there is still some work we can start right now with the present-day facilities. So what is the interest of this kind of study? Is to start studying the physical properties of these objects, let's say the star formation rate activity, their extinction, metallicity, why not the IMF, and also start exploring this new domain to prepare for future studies on the global properties of these guys, number counts, luminosity functions, blah, 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 blah. So this is basically constraining what is happening here in this particular region of this Madaw diagram, where it is the first giga year of the history of the universe, where all this activity is happening. Now, recent results have been published during the last 2 years, basically, by Bowens and collaborators using extremely deep infrared surveys in blank fields, targeting dropouts, for instance, here in the Z-band, constraining the Z equal 6 domain, and also a few dropouts here constraining the redshift domain around 7. And you can see here in these graphs, when you compare the luminosity functions obtained for these guys, basically using the Lyman break criteria to discriminate between the different redshift domains, you can see that the luminosity functions that they obtain here, this is red point for redshift domain about 6, and here in red for redshift domain about 7, is significantly different from the luminosity function that we know very well for Lyman break galaxies around 3 or 4. So there seems to be, according to these results, strong evolution in the luminosity functions of these guys when you consider only these photometric surveys. The same comment concerning this time Lyman alpha emission galaxies. You have this recent publication of a galaxy redshift almost 7, which is issued from this narrow band survey in the reddest possible window in the OH lines in the sky. And this survey has shown that the density of Lyman alpha emitters at redshift about 7 seems to be significantly lower or smaller than the number density of these Lyman alpha emitters at redshift 6.5. So all these results, together with also these Zen results, Z equal 9 survey, which reports the non-detection of galaxies at redshift about 9 using also narrowband survey, seems to be in the direction that something is happening around this redshift in the sense that the properties of galaxies are being modified substantially. In fact, this is what we expect from models. This is a quite old set of models showing that the luminosity function of these galaxies at redshift between 5 and 11 here, moving in this direction, is expected to change, and in particular, the bright part of the luminosity function is expected to be substantially reduced, and we still have here a substantial contribution of low luminosity galaxies to this luminosity function. Now, everything's clear. So, what I'm doing here? Things are not as clear as they seem to be, and there's still room for some discussion. Let me just give you two elements for this discussion. One is that when you consider, instead of the usual Lyman-Break selection technique using colors, just a magnitude-limited sample of galaxies spectroscopically identified, as in the VVDS, for instance, you start seeing galaxies which are bright enough to be selected with this flux-limited sample, but which are, in fact, outside, significantly outside of the selection window for the usual Lyman-Break galaxies. These galaxies, which are actually contributing a lot to this bright part of the luminosity function, and also to the luminosity density of the universe, could be produce a substantial increase on this bright part of the luminosity function already at redshift 3, 4, which is quite moderate redshift. These guys here are not in the Lyman-Break selection window because they are not as extreme in terms of star formation, but they are bright enough. So this means that they were assumed before this epoch. So right in the epochs you are looking at now. There is also increasing evidence of systems found at redshift around 6 here by Yann and collaborators, or here at redshift around 7 in the Woods field here, with IRAC data showing that these objects have a substantial fraction of all stellar population and they are massive enough to be assembled earlier than this redshift 7, 6 or 7 here. So this means consider a large star formation activity at redshift beyond 7, in the 7 and 9. So this is another piece of evidence in the sense that bright objects could exist also in this redshift domain. Now, what gravitational lensing clusters could do for you? If you look at the recent results, I'm going to only to talk about one particular regime, of course. This is the nonlinear regime. I mean the center, the core of lensing clusters where you expect the highest magnification domain in between 1 and 3 magnitudes, typically. This is one of the most well-known examples of this kind of work. This is a galaxy at redshift 6.6, published by Hu and collaborators. This guy was found here in a narrowband survey and confirmed then spectroscopically. And this guy was in fact highly magnified, factor of 4 of between 4 and 5, and recently redetected by IRAC here in two different bands, showing, as you can see here in this recent paper by Shari and collaborators, that this guy is in fact a strong star-forming system, about more than 100 solar masses per year, with some consistent sun reddening, and according to the characteristics of this guy, the first star-forming in this kind of object took place at redshift about 20. This is what the authors explain in their paper. So again, an additional piece of evidence in favor of a strong activity at this redshift. This is another well-known example. This is a well-known cluster of galaxies, ABEL-2218. Here you have an example of a double image of a source at redshift 5.6. This was published by Ellis and collaborators in 2001, quite old already. These two images show the same emission line here in this picture, a strong emission line which is identified as Lyman alpha, highly asymmetric. And also, the most remarkable example is this triple image. You have three different images of the same source, recently identified a couple of years ago by Nave and collaborators. Thanks to the photometric considerations here, you have the object basically appearing, slightly appearing here in the Z-band and then in the near infrared. This galaxy is a redshift of about 7. This is obtained using photometric redshift considerations, and also because of the position of these three images of the same lens. Of the same source. This image was recently studied with IRAC. This is published last year by Gamin collaborators, and you can see here the powerful method which is used here to identify this galaxy and to study the physical properties of this starburst, which is relatively bright. This is in the bright side of luminosity function, this redshift, which is here studied in details thanks to this gravitational telescope approach. Okay, these are very well-known examples. Of course, gravitational telescopes have offered you an additional opportunity that because you know a priori where the critical lines are, you can precisely define the region where you expect to have the most amplified images of background sources. Using this method, here is a very good example of a paper by Santos and collaborators a few years ago. They start exploring with a long slit around the critical lines of nine lensing clusters, and they identify a sample of emission line galaxies, even up to high redshift here. And of course, this work could be continued. This is a very promising method in the using another wavelength domains. For instance, the near infrared, if you want to target more distant sources. This is work done mainly by the Ricciarelli's team in Caltech. So, this is just to convince you that you have examples showing that this is a good technique to proceed with this kind of exercise. Now let's see what happens if you try to make some systematic search for this kind of object in gravitational telescopes. This is a program we started in our group a few years ago. We started with a careful feasibility study, because you understand that in 2001, 2002, 2003, we do not have published luminosity functions to prove that it was feasible with the lensing telescopes, so we have to convince the TAGS. So we started a feasibility study to try to demonstrate to ourselves the feasibility of this kind of research. We obtained the first images in 2002 in the infrared, trying to target these very high Z galaxies using the same Lyman-Blake dropout technique as in blank fields. And after 2003, we started the selection of high Z photometric candidates. We started observing spectroscopically with Isaac at VLT, trying to confirm at least some of the guys in order to have a first spectroscopic sample of confirmed galaxies at redshift beyond 6.5. Okay. So after during the last couple of years, we have been concentrating on acquiring multi-wavelength follow-up of these objects to continue to characterize these candidates. Of course, at the beginning, we start with this feasibility study, taking into account a variety of properties of these guys. For instance, we have been considering a pessimistic, from the point of view of the detection, a pessimistic scenario where these high Z starbursts are made by normal stars with the IMF, the similar IMFs in the local universe, and also considering some extreme cases where the IMF is a top-heavy IMF and you have strong emission lines as the ones you could expect in the population 3 starbursts. In fact, we have decided that there was a compromise, taking into account the typical magnification, which is at least one magnitude in the core of clusters, is that if you reach this, the depth here in this table, in J, H, and K, basically, you could expect to detect stellar mass heroes of the order of a few 10 to the 8 solar masses up to Z equal 10, depending, of course, on the IMF. If you have the pessimistic case, this will be a factor of 10 more massive. Okay, so we have the idea. We know that with this kind of a depth, we can expect put severe constraints on the density of star forming at this redshift. We have been using a combination of near-infrared filters, as you can see here, to target different redshift domains using the usual color-color diagrams, allowing you to separate between low-Z and high-Z galaxies in different ways, combining several different color-color diagrams, looking for optical dropouts, and trying to figure out what the redshift of this color of the optical dropouts was. And for the brightest candidates, we even use photometric redshift considerations with the usual probability distribution and so on. So, two lensing clusters were selected for this exercise. One is the very well-known cluster AC114, redshift 0.3, which is very well-known. showing many multiple images with an extremely good mass model, and the other one was the cluster A1835, which is the brightest cluster in this sample of X-ray clusters, known to have strong lensing, and also a priori, it is extremely massive, and this is a priori the best, possibly the best gravitational telescope we could find in the southern hemisphere. We are looking for this kind of guys. So these are, this is the summary of these observations in these two clusters. I don't have time to describe this in details. We have been selecting guys with different color magnitude diagrams. You can see some of these guys here in this in red here for the brightest ones. So we do not require these guys to be close to the critical lines particularly, just to have a given color and to be optical dropout. Okay. Here you have some of these guys with the error bars in photometry for different selection diagrams. You can see here that in one of these clusters, AC114, the number of candidates we obtain is smaller as in the other cluster. I will talk about this later. And here you have a map showing you the position of these candidates, optical dropouts, around the critical lines, and also the position with respect to the magnification map. This means that the minimum magnification in one of these fields is 0.7 magnitudes, and here you have the lines corresponding to 1, 2, and 3 magnitudes of magnification. Okay? You can see here, for instance, in this case, it's very clear that all your candidates tend to be here. Okay, this candidate here in blue is photometrically identified as a low Z guy, so this is the kind of exercise you can perform. These are some examples of low Z candidates. These are objects which are ambiguous. They are found to be heroes, optical dropouts, not detected in the visible, and with a spectral energy distribution which is compatible both with low and high Z. We have decided to eliminate this from the final study just because they are too bright, even taking into account the magnification, so the low Z identification is more reliable. However, at least one of them, this one here, number 4, you can see here is relatively bright, and all of these guys are now identified here in the IRAC images, you can see. This guy, number 4 here, you can see here, this guy is actually variable, with a variability in two sets of different images 2 weeks apart, which is a factor of 2, it's more than 6 sigma level of significance, and this is highly difficult to understand if this is a mid-Z starburst. Okay, so this is something we are still looking at. At least 3 of our sources in this field are variable. Okay, you have also some other sources which are extremely faint. You can see here has some examples showing you the spectral distribution with huge, large error bars. When you combine all of them together in different ways, excluding these bright sources I have excluded before, you can see here that even if this is an H-band selected sample, you can see the objects in the other bands as well. And of course, we have applied to this sample a number of corrections. Of course, there is lensing correction. You have to correct both for magnification and also dilution in the field in order to compare the density of the sources with blank fields. And we have also corrected for photometric incompleteness in different ways, and also corrected for the possibility of false positive detections. This value depends on the detection filters, on how we have performed the photometry. So we have performed blind tests to show what is the fraction of galaxies, of spurious sources that we expect to detect, given the magnitude and the different filter bands where these sources are detected. We have applied this correction blindly to all our candidates as well. So when you compare the luminosity function obtained in the UV to other people's findings, you can see here this bar showing this luminosity function with the STY fit of this data. As compared to Lyman Break galaxies at redshift of 4 here, this dashed line, and also to the luminosity function I've shown you, the second or third slide here, for Z equals 6 photometric candidates in the Goetz field. You can see here that we basically agree in this part, this is the low luminosity part, but on the contrary, we don't see this turnover here in the bright part. Okay? So this is the first thing. For the moment, don't look at the other lines. We'll comment on this later. Of course, if you integrate here this luminosity function in order to get the transformation density, not surprisingly, our points are located here. These are these red points here. So basically consistent with the same star formation density as for redshift 5 or redshift 6 previous papers, but a factor of a few above the UDF estimates for the same redshift domain. However, we are in perfect agreement with the maximum, because in our case it's also a maximum value, because this is the number of candidates, photometric candidates. We are not counting for unity of interlopers here. We are in good agreement with the maximum star formation rate density derived from the Wood's data for the Z equals 7. Z dropout sources I shown before with IRAC data. When you take, as the authors, Labbé and collaborators, have done, the maximum stellar mass in these systems divided by the minimum time H of these systems together. So this is about the estimate they obtain in this sample. So we are not far away from this. Let's see that there is room for discussion. In fact, we are in agreement with some models, consistent models. The star formation rate they predict here at redshift below 10 is supposed, could be very high. So in this sense, we are not in disagreement with this theoretical expectation, at least with some models. On the contrary, the discrepancies we have with other determination in blank fields could be due to different reasons. Of course, one is sample variance. Just let me tell you something. We have two different lensing clusters, okay? In one of the clusters, A1835, we detect two-thirds of the candidates for one-third of the total volume surveyed in this, in our sample. In the other cluster, we have two-thirds of the volume and only one-third of the candidates. So already in our round sample, we have strong field-to-field variance. This is one thing. The other thing is that we have, as I will show you, we could have something which is different from blank fields, is mid-Z interlopers, which are also magnified, and they are integrated in our samples, and they are not in blank fields. So this is something to quantify. Could have a serious effect on the statistics in this kind of lensing fields. You have to take this into account. And of course, you cannot exclude residual contamination of another kind, but as I've shown before, we have taken into account many different sources of contamination in these final statistics. When you look more carefully at the properties of these objects, we found out that they are basically faint, typically a few 10 to the 8 solar masses with the standard IMF. And when you use the Kennicott conversion between UV luminosity and star forming activity, we end up with a star formation rate of between a few units and 20 solar masses per year, typically. But be careful, because we are talking about objects which are not necessarily reaching equilibrium conditions to apply this kind of conversion. Another interesting thing is that when you look at the UV slope of the continuum in these sources, it is very blue. Actually, the beta, the slope of the continuum given by beta is between minus 1.5 minus 3.5. So right here in this diagram for different models, and this is also a trend, a general trend, which is also observed in other similar photometric candidates in blank fields. So this seems to be a characteristic of these objects also in this case. We have started studying these objects in the using new HST and also IRAC speeder data. Basically, all our bright eros are observed in Z, except one or two of them, and even some of our even secondary candidates. We confirm the break in most cases. All the bright guys are detected in the IRAC data, as I've shown before. But the faint ones are not. This is not surprising, because they are too faint beyond the reach of this IRAC data. So we are now starting to study, to integrate this photometry into this study of the spectral distribution. And the hope is that this will help us characterizing the properties of these guys, and in particular, breaking the degeneracy when it is possible between mid-Z and high-Z, when it still exists. Now, concerning the spectroscopic follow-up, as I mentioned before, spectroscopic follow-up today is a very difficult business, because we are using ISAC and long-slit spectrograph, so this is long-slit spectrograph, and we are, in the infrared, set in the same position as in the 80s in the optical domain. I mean, you are acquiring objects, two objects at a time when you are lucky. And we are covering the full G domain in five different exposures, you know? So this is highly inefficient. It's a tedious process, time-consuming, highly inefficient. You have tried for the best candidates, at least, and you have found emission lines for at least two-thirds of our candidates. Not all of them are high-Z candidates. For instance, I show here two very faint emission lines. This is the signal-to-noise of these lines is typically a few units between 4 and 10, depending on the size of the aperture you use to detect them, these lines. And in one case, we have published this guy. This is a low-Z interloper. This was a secondary candidate. This one is also a mid-Z interloper. The problem is that you have to confirm these lines independently with a new measurement, of course, and also you have to exclude that this object being a mid-Z interloper, observing other lines that should be there if it is a low-Z interloper. So it takes a long time. It's very time-consuming. So we have observations that ESO accepted for this. A bunch of these observations were sent recently, and we have new observations coming in the Z-band also for this kind of stuff. Possibly we'll have this data in 1 or 2 weeks, I hope so. But it takes very easily 2-3 years to confirm these lines. I mean, it's like, this is not efficient at all. This is why we have to ask this question, is about the efficiency of this kind of process. Okay, I will not comment more on the spectroscopy. You can ask me questions if you have questions about that. Let me just move to next topic, is trying to discuss a bit with you, with the data in hand, what is more efficient? Continue with gravitational telescopes or move to blank fields? This is, of course, my point of view, and I am open to all the discussions. Now, the effect of lensing in a gravitational telescope is you have two opposite trends. One is, of course, magnification. Your objects will be brighter if they are still compact. You will gain, in detection, you will gain in efficiency when you start with your spectrograph targeting these sources. On the other side, you have the dilution effect. If you have a magnification factor of 5, your effective field of view is 5 times smaller. So you have to combine these two effects together. Oops, there's some problem with... If you consider now this observed now as luminosity function, there's some kind of a optimistic and pessimistic limit on the object we are looking at, these redshifts, you can start playing a bit with your gravitational telescopes and figure out what is the number of sources that you could expect up to a given magnitude. This magnitude is not... the magnitude is h equal 24, which roughly corresponds to the UV flux that you need in order to detect an emission line if present in one of these objects. So let's see what happens. If you consider the field of view, a typical field of view of Isaac, for instance, this means a few arc minutes aside, and this is not very different from the typical field of view of the near-infrared spectrographs coming, you can see that you compare the number counts you expect in a blank field here in dashed lines as compared to a lensed field for this kind of gravitational lens is a redshift about 0.2, 0.3, you can see that you expect a positive magnification bias in the sense that the number of sources that you expect to find, and we actually find more sources in this field, so it's like a confirmation of this kind of an effect, could be up to a factor of 10 more efficient. Okay? So this is good for us, because this means you point to a lensing cluster, you expect to have more photometric candidates to point. So this seems to be a fact. Okay, we are using here a toy model to integrate this number count, but you obtain the same thing if you directly integrate luminosity functions, because I shown before that this is about the same. Now, what happens is that, as I shown before, the luminosity function got a large spread, a large error bar in the bright part of this luminosity function. So we still don't know what we are talking about. So in order to correct for this, to prevent also for the contamination due to mid-Z interlopers, we absolutely need to perform the same kind of an exercise in a blank field, but with a large field of view this time. This means multiplying by a factor of at least 100 the present-day field of view in the goods, for instance, on the UDF. This is absolutely needed. So I've put here in this graph some numbers telling you what are the number counts you expect till up to a given limiting magnitude in the H-band here with my optimistic and pessimistic model, the ones which are more or less constraining the observed luminosity functions today, to see how we could perform such a survey. This survey today can be done using the present-day large field of view near-infrared cameras and 4-meter telescopes. But way to go to try to perform the same kind of an exercise using an 8-meter telescope but with enough large field of view. So there's a compromise to find. If you want to detect a few guys, you are moving here in this region. This is giving you the kind of depth. This is in Vega magnitude, okay? This is Vega magnitude, so it's true that you add the 1.4 if you want to have this in AB. And here you have the filter combination you have to use. So this is absolutely needed now, and this could be done with a reasonable exposure time. This means of the order of between 60 and 100 hours in a 4-meter telescope. Okay? No, this is the number of objects in a field of view, typical field of view, which is 30 per 30 arcminutes, which is typically the field of view of one of these cameras I'm talking about, order of magnitude. So, just a couple of comments, additional comments, is that you understand that there seems to be a positive magnification bias in our favor to target these sources in lensing clusters. If you look at the characteristics of new infrared facilities, in particular, multi-object spectrograph in the near-infrared, for instance, here you have an example, this is a mirror spectrograph in Gran Tecan, but it is the same when you consider the facilities available, Tuvalu, for instance, Flamingos 2 and Gemini South, and so on. This kind of near-infrared facilities coming have typically a field of view of a few arcminutes aside, okay, with a multiplex capability of a few tens of objects. Okay, so if you take this into account and you consider the numbers I gave before, you end up with the conclusion that for the spectroscopic survey, you absolutely have to use this kind of field, this gravitational telescope field. Of course, this is not black and white. You have also to consider correcting for all these biases and effects that you have when using gravitational lensing telescopes, that is contamination by mid-G interlopers, and also you have to perfectly know the gravitational lens in order to correct with respect to a Planck field. So you have two cases. Okay, so I think I'm going to summary and conclusions. So if you look at the first results obtained with using gravitational telescopes in this redshift domain, we end up with a constant transformation rate density up to a redshift about 10, and we do not observe this turnover in the bright end of luminosity function. However, you have to take into account the strong field-to-field variance that we have presently in lensing fields and also in Planck fields, the large correction that we have applied here to a relatively small sample of galaxies, and also the contamination with respect to Planck fields coming from different sources. So at some point, spectroscopic and photometric confirmation is needed for all these candidates. Second point is gravitational lensing clusters seem to be more efficient than Planck fields to explore this domain to the same photometric depth and for a given field of view. Of course, positive magnification bias is expected from simulations and seems to be confirmed with these first results. However, there's a potential problem with mid-G interlopers. We have to quantify this effect as soon as possible. Also, the spectroscopic follow-up seems to be optimized in lensing fields with the new generation of near-infrared multi-object spectrographs because of the field of view, multiplexing capabilities, and spectral resolution, which are very well in the domain where gravitational lenses are efficient. And of course, large field-to-field variance in the strong magnification regime and also in these smaller Planck fields could be corrected or at least understood if we start looking at wide field surveys in the near infrared. So I think that's all that I want to tell you. If you have questions, I'm open to your questions.
I'm sure there are some questions.
Could you please remind me how many objects you find in your most reliable category and over what effective area at the redshift of 7 or 8?
Yes, if you are talking about the faint ones, the ones that we do not exclude because of luminosity considerations, you are talking about 8 good candidates in one cluster, 5 good candidates in the other.
In the effective area?
The effective area, good question. When you add up together the effective area on the sky corresponding to the same depth as for the UDF, we have half of the surface for the same depth, but we have a larger surface with less depth, with an equivalent depth which is smaller than in UDF. So you cannot just combine like that, you have to combine all the pixels together. But to give you an idea about the order of magnitude, which is important here, in our fields, to the same depth, we have half of the equivalent surfaces in the ultra-deep field. But on the other side, we have larger magnifications in some places. So, you know, we cannot just combine like that. But to the same depth, it's half of the surface.
Of course, contamination is a big problem, right? Mm. So if you try this simple experiment to take blank fields, Isaac fields, reduced exactly in the same way to the same depth. So if the population is contaminated at a different redshift, they should be differently amplified. So you should find a difference and you can check whether you really gain or not.
Oh, this is true.
Have you tried?
No, because you don't have uniform data. One of the problems is to get uniform data.
Yeah, you can get them from the archive. I mean, whatever they point, right?
Sure, but you still need optical, same, you know, you have to perform the same kind of selection.
Right.
So you have to be careful, but it's feasible in principle, yes.
Other questions? Okay. Thank you again, Robert.